Our next speaker is Robert Brush, who I first met when he was running General Motors.
No.
I don't think I can enumerate all the things he did, but his title is Application-Oriented R&D.
There we go. All right. I'm going to talk slightly differently, and not so much as to you as physicists, but to you as scientists, since I'm a physicist who could be described as having gotten lost on the way, although I never stopped being a physicist. And my concentration will be not so much on what's different as on what has been the same. It's been a long time, so there's a lot to say. I'm talking about application-oriented R&D, by which I mean just in a general way that the object is not just or only curiosity or development of science. There's some feeling of purpose behind it, either a business to be supported or a national purpose to be supported or something of the sort. So it's motivated by questions and problems that tend to come from outside or from yourself pretending to be somebody from the outside and making up what you think the question is. And the motto, of course, as has been all of our implicit motto, is nature to be commanded must be obeyed. That is, you can't force things to operate other than by the laws that govern the universe, so you better find out what those laws are if you're going to make something work. And just to put a context, my first job was with a laboratory that was doing work for the Office of Naval Research and trying to untangle very long-range ocean properties that would lead to submarine detection. Very long range being 1,000 miles. Then I moved into ARPA, where I did nuclear test detection, was deputy director. I was assistant secretary of the Navy for R&D, assistant director of the UN Environment Program. I was at Woods Hole as an associate director. I ran NASA for President Carter, and I ended up for 11 years being the vice president of GM in charge of research labs. So aphorisms and anecdotes. One, they're all sort of alike. There are the cultural differences, but the idea that a profit-making corporation is fundamentally different than a U.S. government or a laboratory that's working for a purpose, there are differences, but they're fundamentally alike. Scale is very important. That is, large organizations are different than small organizations because of the way you're embedded into them. But organizations are self-similar at all levels. That is to say, you always have somebody supervising a few people, and each of the few people is then a boss supervising somebody else, and each of those all the way down. So it's a hierarchical stack of similar small organizations. Now, of course, you have to know that the official organization, what it says on the diagram, is not necessarily the real organization, which is likely to be a set of networks, people who lunch together and therefore are a piece of the organization and who may be embedded in different departments in different ways. And let me give you an example. One of the people we had at GM Research Labs somewhat at my instigation, was a cultural anthropologist, an ethnologist, who we hired sort of just for the hell of it. And she looked around and found interesting things to do. And one of them had to do with parts chasing. I don't know if any of you have ever been in an automobile assembly plant, but it's maybe a quarter of a mile long. There are 3,000 people on a shift. Pieces of metal and stuff come in at one end and in the sides, and at the end somebody drives away a new car 65 times an hour. It's a very complicated organization. Now, sometimes, as you might expect, for the particular car being assembled, the part isn't there. The radio that's supposed to go in that car isn't at the place where it should be. And so there's a recognized job of people on the line called parts chasing. If the part isn't there, where's the part? Can I get the part so we don't have to stop the line and get into all sorts of trouble? And a plant called up and said, we have a problem with parts chasing. They must have been desperate. Nobody calls the research labs unless they're desperate. And so Liz Briety went off to find out about the parts chasing problem. And everybody agreed there was an official way to chase parts, and the organization told you how to do it. But everybody also agreed that nobody actually chased parts the way the official organization said you chased parts. They had a description of this is how parts are chased. So Liz poked around in the factory. Being a cultural anthropologist, she knew how to ask questions without being offensive and how to disappear into the background and keep everybody happy. And she discovered that the way everybody agreed parts chasing was done was not the way parts chasing was actually done. There was a third cultural level, which was the way it was actually done. And it was something in the third cultural level that was making the trouble. So she made a few suggestions as to how to make that system work all right. And they tried it, and it was fine. Well, our habit was to write a paper, a case paper, on anything like that, and distribute it all over the corporation so other people might learn from it. And for about a year thereafter, at regular intervals, Liz Briety would get a phone call from somebody who'd say, I'm the plant manager of, or I'm the production manager of such and such a plant, and I want to know how you got into my plant and found out all that stuff about parts chasing without my knowing it. To which the answer was, it wasn't your plant. It was simply a universal phenomenon of something down in the works. You have to have bureaucracy, rules, policies. That's all necessary. Otherwise, the system can't work at all. But please note, nobody who's obeying all the rules can possibly be doing any work. And that's why the work to rule non-strike is so devastating, because nothing actually gets done if everybody's obeying all the rules. The problem is people add rules without thinking about it too much. And after a while, you have an overlay of rules and rules and rules and a non-self-consistent set so that you can't actually do all this. I have to say that in all my time in the Pentagon, essentially all of the breaches of security systems came about because the person who breached them couldn't figure out how to actually do their work if they followed the security system. And there's a tendency for R&D organizations to note that and to operate in their own ways. And here's a recent, very recent cartoon describing the bureaucratic problem. Maybe we should hire a consultant to figure out why production has slowed down and the system is obviously inverted. There are too many bosses and only one guy at the oars. The interesting thing is that was in the Boston Globe about 3 weeks ago. And here's one I got from a colleague in the UK about 40 years ago, pointing out that you had an administrator of reviews and all these various levels of review, and down at the lower left is the working staff consisting of one lone worker. So I conclude that the bureaucratic problem has not changed in years. And by the way, on matrices that I'll come to in a minute, on organizational matrices, they do not have eigenvalues. That is, there's no such thing as a good organization. Okay. Now, the next thing to note is that on the way from a research lab to production, there's a shift in culture and in discipline. In the research lab, early in R&D, the discipline is more or less embedded in the scientific training, in the ethic of being a scientist. That is, it's in your work habits, it's in the way in which you deal with publication. Nobody has to tell you how to be careful, how to take notes, how to know what you're doing, how to worry about how things work. But as you get closer and closer to the production line, you're likely to be dealing more and more with people who didn't grow up with a scientific discipline, and in fact may not have the same habits of doing things carefully and in the same way. So more and more one has to say what the formal discipline is, and when you get to a production line, in fact it has to be frequently by rote or by careful conversation with the workers so that they understand why things are the way they are. It's a somewhat different kind of shift. Now, this is very important. The customer for R&D is always wrong. And I don't mean that by saying the technologist or the R&D person is always right. I'm really talking about a disconnect between what they're trying to do. The problem I have found is that the customers don't really think about it in terms of what their underlying problem is. They think about it in terms of what they guess the solution might be. So they instead of saying, my problem is, they tend to say, what I want is a gadget that will do thus and so. And besides, most of the customers over on the business side don't know much about the technical possibilities, and the technologist, as has been illustrated in previous talks, may or may not know what will work in the business at all. So this is a built-in problem, and here's a thing. The admiral in charge of airplanes in the Navy comes and says, we have to have faster fighter aircraft. Well, Tom, why do you need faster fighter aircraft? Well, because when we get into a dogfight, we want to be faster than the other guy. But Tom, the first thing that happens in a dogfight is you make a turn, and your velocity vector has just gone to zero, and you're not going anyplace very fast at all. Why do you need a faster airplane? So long pause, and he comes back. Well, we need a faster airplane so we can get to the dogfight before the other guy gets to the dogfight. Now, why do you want to do that? Well, I want to be able to shoot him down before I come into direct contact with him. Oh, so you don't need a faster fighter aircraft. What you need is maybe a longer range weapon that can get to the dogfight even before the airplane gets to the dogfight. Oh, so we started talking about airplanes and ended up talking about weapons, and I think that's a kind of prototypical discussion. And I'll come back to discussion in a minute. Now, this is a real problem, particularly for government organizations, but it's true in industrial cases as well. Buying R&D is not like buying shoes. I go to a shoe store, they have shoes all laid out, I can try on the shoes and say I like these, don't like these. Can't do that with R&D. The product of R&D, by definition, doesn't exist when you start doing R&D. They're talking about future possibilities that do not yet exist, can't be seen, can't be tried on. And so it's a different kind of thing. You're buying, the old American expression was, a pig in a poke, namely something in a sack, but you're not allowed to open the sack until later and find out what's really there. So there's that kind of a disconnect. In the military, they give you requirements, namely we need an airplane that can do thus and so. But those are really guesses about when they're requirements for R&D, they're guesses about possible futures. By the way, specifications, even for something you have already built, don't actually specify. They're an incomplete selection taken from a real object, and they only tell you certain things about it. And there may, in fact, be tacit knowledge. Tacit knowledge is things that people in the craft know but don't know they know, so they never write them down. And here's a requirement problem, and I've actually seen this Navy requirement. We would like a helicopter which can take off from 14,000 feet on a 90-degree day. About $500 million was spent in getting a helicopter that could barely take off because it had to carry all of that. And of course, there is no such place as 14,000 feet at 90 degrees. What had happened was somebody who was in the business of writing requirements but didn't know any geophysics or meteorology saw two requirements when he thought one would do, and so he put them together. Tacit knowledge. Now, this is a Hughes story from a long time ago. Traveling wave tube, big vacuum tube, which goes in the front end of a military radar and usually has a long lifetime, thousands of hours, enough so it's almost like an anvil. You put it in the airplane, you don't expect to have to change it. One day, they started coming apart. Instead of 1,000 hours in 10 or 20 hours. That was a real problem. Hughes couldn't find any problem. The line was the way it had always been, so on. Finally, in desperation, they looked at who had left the line, who had retired, and they found a guy had retired from the line. And they got him back and told him, walk the line and see if you find anything different. And he came to the place where they were welding filaments and said, no, you have to turn the tube upside down on the table when you weld the filaments, otherwise the sag is the wrong way and the filaments will burn out too soon. That's tacit knowledge. It had not occurred to anybody to write down in the manual or tell anybody you have to turn the tube upside down. Okay, this we all know, inventing and defining the right problem is generally even harder than solving the problem. And this I just threw in because it's a perpetual problem with new ideas. The one who says it cannot be done should not get in the way of the one who is actually doing it. Now, next point. This is a contact sport. That it is, as was pointed out before, this is not something you do in the isolation of your own lab. It is a complicated business once you get beyond sort of the original scientific idea. There's a lot of dialogue, discussion, and argument, particularly in defining what the problem is that you might want to solve. So there's an early dialogue, arm's length dealing, so beloved of the procurement people, does not work. People have to be talking together. But of course, not a random conversation, but a disciplined conversation. And then, of course, you have to continue talking about it because these specifications and requirements are likely to be not quite right when you try to go to actual use and production. And arm's length dealing doesn't work. These days, it's very popular to say all dealing should be at arm's length because of conflict of interest. Everybody involved in a subject they know something about has a conflict of interest. Money conflicts are frequently the most trivial kind. One just has to assume that people have biases and conflicts because they bring something to it if they actually know something about the subject. So you have to continue the dialogue even though somebody says, oh, well, so-and-so can't be involved in this, they have a conflict of interest. Well, of course they do. And so you play poker with everybody's hands and cards on top of the table, and you trust but verify. Okay, where am I? Okay. Well, I'll skip that comment. This thing is much too jumpy, or I am. Okay. Now, you can't suddenly say, well, we finished this project and it's gone off to use by the Navy and gone off to production or it's going to be launched, because it's like the shoe buyer syndrome. You finished the R&D, so to speak, but nobody's actually had a long period of using it, and there are going to be problems in actual use and production, so you have to be around and involved, and the one who is involved in the R&D has to be available to be of use to the people who are going to apply the R&D. Another comment which is important about the jobs of R&D labs, it's easy to know what's relevant. It's usually impossible to know what is irrelevant, so you have to do a lot of guessing about things you might want to work on because they might want to be, might end up being useful. Here's an example. Somebody tried to make the door of a vehicle for the first time out of glass fiber reinforced polymers, and everything was fine. In order to design the door so it didn't buckle too easily, a rib was designed in as part of the molded plastic, and everything was fine until they started to produce the ribs, and then they discovered that if you looked at the door, even after it was painted, you could see the ghost of the rib. Somehow it was changing the stress in the door. And that was a really serious problem. So once again, they were so desperate, they called the research labs. And the polymers guys who had worked on this sort of thing went over and got a door and came back and worked on it. And after about 2 weeks, they went back to the plant and said, let's have a look at the molding and the molding machinery and the cooling systems in the molding machinery, and said, oh yes, would you move this cooling tube over 5 centimeters, and that one should run at a different temperature. And the read through, the ability to see the rib, vanished. And the problem was solved, and the customer, the general manager of the division, said, that must have been easy, you guys solved it in 2 weeks. But of course, they'd been worrying about problems like that for 25 years. And at any time in the 25 years, somebody could have come in and said, I don't see why you guys are doing that. And their view was, we need to understand how these things work so that when a problem comes, we can fix it. Here's another one of irrelevancy. I mentioned what an assembly plant is like. And you have a problem of scheduling it. You want to do a week's work of what cars are you going to build at 65 an hour for 8 hours a day for 5 days a week if you're not doing too many. And you want to schedule them in an order so you'd love to paint all the white ones in sequence and then shift to red and so on. You don't want a 6-cylinder and a 4-cylinder engine being put into 2 cars in sequence because 6-cylinder engines take longer to put in than 4-cylinder engines. You've got different radios, you've got different mixes, you've got 4-door cars and 2-door cars. So getting this all scheduled is a terrible problem. And the system that had been used for scheduling it was simply good, but not good enough. So the guys started to figure out how could you do this rather multi-dimensional queuing problem in some way that you could have a reasonable sequence. And they figured out what to do and then found themselves faced with an optimization problem that they didn't know how to optimize. They just didn't have an algorithm for optimizing this. It was the scale of a problem that in those days took the Cray all night to do one job. And there was a luncheon conversation of a group of people who shouldn't have been talking together because they came from different parts of the place, and the engineer was describing this problem, and there was I don't think it was a mathematician, I think it was a solid-state physicist who listened to this and said, that's a very familiar problem, tell me what that problem is again. And he said, well, I think there's a theorem. And he came back the next day, he said, well, there isn't quite a theorem, but I've adjusted it so there is a theorem, and that solved the problem and eventually was worth a great deal of money to the company because it simplified the whole scheduling problem. What the hell was the solid-state physicist doing in this problem? Well, he wasn't irrelevant, he was very relevant, and people with general skills are very useful. We were asked to, I'm going to skip this one and come to some other things. Now this is not a business, none of the businesses I've been in have been businesses in which you do something with one discipline. You do things with N disciplines all operating at once. And here's an example. A more efficient lower emissions auto engine involves some or all of the following. And so you can call this a matrix. You need chemistry, mechanical engineering. For lubrication, you need chemistry, mechanical engineering, material physics, and fluid flow. So you're back in this matrix team kind of operation in order to do anything useful. Therefore, you have to have some kind of central organization. If you put all the R&D, divide it up, and put it somewhere in the divisions, then you're not going to quite be able to operate. At least matrix management, and here's my eigenvalue comment. And for example, how many mathematicians does a division of an automobile company need? Well, maybe not even one most of the time. But sometimes it's going to need some mathematical help. So somewhere there has to be somebody who knows where the mathematicians are, either having them in a pot for use or at least knowing where they're going. So it's a team kind of problem. And of course, as has been hinted at in the previous talks, you don't just do product development, you do process development, problem solving. You do intelligence, you do S&T, and you do education and training for the company. Two key management positions. I worked for Dave Packard in the Navy Department for a while. Management by walking around, that is, you can't manage it from the front office. You have to know what's going on, and the only way to do that is to know and see. This is one I just invented, when thinking about how one operates, management by asking questions. And the most important question that doesn't get asked is, so what can go wrong? This is a wonderful thing. What can go wrong? And then there are others too. Well, I've owned a number of ships that had to carry very heavy objects. A transducer for experimental work that weighed between 50 and 100 tons, where you took a 10,000 ton ship and cut a sea chest through it and hung the thing below it. And in a redesign session for such a ship, out of clear blue, I said to the guys who were showing me how wonderful the design was, what happens if the string breaks? Don't worry, boss, the string won't break. It has a factor of safety. After a while, I said, humor me. Go find out what happens if the string breaks. And the next day, I got called over to the office, and everybody was a little green and said, well, boss, if the string actually breaks, we assumed at the middle, there's a wave that goes up the string, and when it gets to the part of the ship that's holding all of this, that part jumps up and comes down and breaks the back of the ship, and it goes to the bottom in 30 seconds. But the good news is we figured out how to prevent that. And it's very easy, and we don't have to redesign the ship. Now, how does the stuff actually get into use? I'm just going to comment that you don't do it by sending paper. You have to send people who actually know what it's about, or you have to import people to the research lab who will learn what it's all about and move it. We invented what we called synthetic alumni at GM, namely people who wanted a production career, an operating career, but not a research career, but had good scientific or engineering backgrounds, about a master's level. And we imported them to the lab for a year or so while they learned that, and then exported them to the division where they were the carrier of a valuable new technology and a link back with the research labs. Now, we have to think of everything in a larger system context, and I automatically think of it as the engine block is in the engine, in the powertrain, in a vehicle, on the road, and somehow think of it up and down to nuclei and protons, and from where did the iron ore come from to where does the scrap go all at once. It's a very useful thing, but again, you're not being just a physicist, you're being a whole lot of other things in this business. One final thing, how do I know whether the research labs are paying the rent or not? And One, you can't do it project by project because many of them fail. Most of what goes on in a research lab never goes into the business. And you don't know what the success rate of individual projects would be. Well, if I had a NASA Center director who said everything we did last year was successful, and my response was, are you going to try something hard next year? We sampled a whole bunch of projects at the GM research labs and figured out what their value to the company was and discovered that our internal rate of return was 70%. The management didn't understand that because it said right there that we were a cost center and not a profit center, so they couldn't award us any profit. And the structure of it was a few things every year hit big. Most stuff every year wasn't clear what it was going to come to, and it didn't matter, but it contributed to that. And with that, I'm through.
Please repeat them.
Certainly. Questions, comments, vicious attacks? Okay, stunned. All right. I grant that. Okay, the question is, if you're going to move people around in the company, does one have to change the way graduate students are educated? Have I got it? Well, not necessarily. There's a kind of a self-selection involved. That is, lots of people who come into the research labs don't really want to do anything except do R&D in the research labs. I always had division directors or division people from GM saying, all of your research people should work for a time in a division, to which my answer was, I would not subject either all of them or any of you to some of the people in the research lab. It's a matter of self-selection. And we always had a few people in the research labs who were interested in shifting their careers. And we hired people. Only in the sense that the sort of graduate school culture has too much stratification in some ways that I think are not healthy. You know, I grew up as a physicist at Columbia in the late 40s and early 50s, and there was a clear hierarchy. There were mathematicians, there were theoretical physicists doing fundamental particle stuff, there were experimental physicists and so on, and my comment was, it's sort of, I do pure research, you do applied research, they are engineers. And I think those artificial distinctions we can do without. It's a matter of self-selection. Some people would like to stick to one kind of thing, other people would like to take a broader view, and I think the social distinctions that we've built in are not terribly helpful.
Any more questions?
I cede the remainder of my time to the following speaker.
I can untangle myself.